You are listening to the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee with your host, Dr. Janine James, Brother Kwasi Kraft, and Sister Dee Combs. Sankofa Council Radio Broadcast is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, and it airs on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. Reach out to them at SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. I repeat, SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. All of our programs are archived, so just go to www.timeforanawakening, access the search portal, and type in the name of the program you desire to review.
This is in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in the United States. We stand with you.
We're poor, Ashe. We're poor to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge, Ashe. We pour to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who raised the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places, learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God, oh Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand, and who sit here, buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, "Stop! No more! We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths." We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names.
Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X,
John Henry Clark, John Jackson, Jacob Carruthers, And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee with your host, Dr. Janine James, Brother Kwasi Kraft, and Sister Dee Combs. Sankofa Council Radio Broadcast is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, and it airs on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. Reach out to them at SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. I repeat, SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. All of our programs are archived, so just go to www.timeforanawakening, access the search portal, and type in the name of the program you desire to review.
Welcome. This is Dr. Janine James and Brother Charles Robinson, Sister Dee Dee Conley, and we are happy to be here with you today. We are very excited about being able to continue our program that we initiated last week, Kitty Boot Camp. So today we're doing Kitty Boot Camp Part 2, Legacy Building. And we are so happy to have as our guest today, Baba Derek Rogers. And I'm going to hand it over to Brother Charles, Brother Quojo, to bring us up to what we're going to be talking about today.
Good evening.
Good evening, family.
We're going to be talking to Baba Derek Rogers, and let me give a brief introduction of who he is. Derek Baba Rogers is a retired educator from the Milwaukee Public Schools. He is considered to be one of Wisconsin's foremost thinkers and practitioners in the areas of African-centered, liberatory, and alternative education. Baba Rogers is also an ordained minister and former pastor of Compassion Ministries, whose ministry focuses on Black liberation theology and decolonial theology. He is currently the director of 414 Life Violence Interruption. That's 414 Life Violence Interruption, an organization that takes a public health and cultural-based approach to gun violence reduction in Milwaukee. And without any further ado, Brother Derek Rogers, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I appreciate being a part of this program. Some esteemed individuals that are associated with this program. And just before I even go any further, if I could just take a quick second, I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge on this August 21st, 2021, we're in Black August. Black Resistance Month, and, you know, on this date in 1831, the Reverend Nat Turner initiated a rebellion that was heard around the country and that still reverberates to this day. I just wanted to pay honor, homage, and reverence to Nat Turner on this day and what he did in terms of revolutionary thought for our people.
Thank you for that acknowledgement.
Yes.
A lot of times we just see ourselves as victims, and we just took what the slave owners gave us. But yes, there were, they say, 247 major slave uprisings during that 40-some period of time. Yes, they had 247 slave uprisings, and Nat Turner is the most famous one.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thank you for being in this conversation. I haven't had a chance to be in touch with you in such a long time. We have a lot in common. We taught at the same middle school, Malcolm X Junior High School. When you were there, and when I was there, it was Robert Fulton Junior High School.
Yeah.
And then we had a lot of history. And we share the same mentor.
I apologize, Brother Charles. Can I get my ancestral profile in right quick?
Oh.
I apologize.
Please.
Okay. It's just that the person that I wanted to get it in on, she's one of my favorites. I just love her. I'm going to do my good evening, family. And Barbara Rogers, thank you so much about that with Nat Turner. Thank you. I was just reading that article this morning. Appreciate that. But anyway, I'm going to do my ancestral profile. It's going to be on Frances Quest Wesley. I love her. First, I just want to say how Dr. Ben Yohanan, how he described her. I must say this. He called her a warrior queen, which she was, an African warrior queen. Then he went on to say, dipped in chocolate, bronze in elegance, enameled with grace, toasted with beauty. And then he went on to say, my Lord, she's a black woman. And for those of us, which I know a lot of people know Dr. Ben, he was quite comical, but he was a great historian also. So anyway, I'm going to get on. Frances Quest Wesley, a psychiatrist best known for writing the ISIS papers, was born Frances Luella Quest in Chicago, Illinois, on March 18, 1935. Wesley, who was the child of a physician, her dad's name was Henry Quest, and her mother, which was an educator, she was a teacher, so her name was Ida Mae Griffin. And Wesley grew up the middle of three sisters. She received her Bachelor's of Science from Antioch College in Ohio in 1957, and her medical degree from Washington D.C.'s Harvard University in 1962. After earning her M.D., Wesley stayed in Washington D.C. pursuing a career in child and general psychiatry. Wesley spent nearly 25 years working as a staff physician for D.C.'s Department of Human Services, and also as a clinical director of two schools, catering to children with emotional troubles. Wesley opened her own practice in D.C. in 1967. Through her published works and her research, she sought out to help bring about a solution to the mental health problems of the black community by understanding racism. Wesley published her first major work, The Quest Theory of Color Confrontation, as an essay in 1974, while assistant professor at Howard University. In the controversial essay, Wesley argued that the drive for white supremacy and superiority stems from pervasive feelings of inadequate and inferiority. Wesley claimed that whiteness was in fact a deficiency, evidenced by the inability of whites and other races to produce melanin, which generated skin color. In short, white people in America could not cohabit peacefully with their black peers, according to Dr. Frances, because of a deep-seated jealousy of people with melanin and their embrace of racial supremacy. To accommodate these feelings, the essay was controversial. It was controversial, and according to Dr. Frances, it prevented her from not only gaining tenure at Howard, but in fact losing her teaching post. And Then I also wanted to say a quote that Frances once said. Frances Crest, one of her quotes I really love, and she said, "I won't rest until Black children are taught to love themselves as themselves." I really love that. Frances passed away in 2016, family, and I just wanted to say something about her today. Because you're talking about building legacy. While if anyone gets a chance, which I'm sure a lot of us on here knows about her, it's just so inspiring and so interesting. I love reading her quotes, and I love her book, Isis Papers. If you can, family, get that. Look that up. Thank you very much, Brother Charles, for letting me get that in.
Thank you, Sister Dee Dee. That is so powerful. Dr. Cress Welsick is a legend, and reading her work should be required by everybody.
Ooh,
really.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother Charles. You're right.
You know, this is part two of our Kitty Boot Camp, and it's entitled Legacy Building. Let me take a minute and read our Sankofa editorial about this particular segment. We're living in a time to learn from our past to benefit the future of our children through the content of the education they will receive. There are great opportunities for them to live their best lives. This will be achieved by taking a very critical look at the content of the academic and social knowledge that will be provided to them. The content mm-hmm. of the education must include the truthful inclusion of the accomplishments of their ancestors. Mm-hmm. They will need critical thinking skills in addition to their ability to communicate their ideas. We have the expertise to evaluate the curriculum and provide an approach to treat behaviors that will limit the ability of our children and to become productive, successful, and fulfilled. So that's the discussion we're having this evening, people. And Dr. Derek Rogers will share some strategies and some other insights about what we could possibly do to solve the problems in education and also violence in our community. So I'm looking forward to having another conversation with Brother Rogers. And to reconnect, because we haven't compared notes in a while.
That's right. It's been a while. It's past time. So much as, you know, there's so many iterations of this, as they say. This stuff shifts. The assault on us, the overall assault, that stays the same. But the methodology, the approaches, the ways that white supremacy imposes itself upon us, It's clever. It's not more clever.
Well, you know, that slavery never ended. It just evolved.
That's right. It just evolved. And now there's, you know, Brother Charles, there's like these micro evolutions that occur. I mean, you, I won't even say every 5 years, every couple years, every 2 years. And, one of the things that we haven't been good at is keeping up with those iterations and finding ways to not only combat it but overcome. And so that's why I'm glad to be able to have conversations like this.
Yeah, there has been an ebb and flow up and down throughout the history. A lot of people don't realize back in 1870, I think 1870, we have more representation in Congress than we've ever had.
Absolutely.
And then when you look at like 50 years after the end of slavery, you have a community in Greenwood, Oklahoma, that was rivaling Wall Street.
Yes.
And then we had, you know, the backlash of all of that, too, that set us back. And so we've been going back and forth and up and down for a while, and we should know the strategy by now. We should.
Yes.
You know, their strategy doesn't change that much. It has a different color, you know, but it's still designed to suppress us and oppress us.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what about what can we do in education now that we know that we have the right to vote now? We can control our school boards if we come out to the, you know, to the elections. You know, what's going on in our community that our children are not being educated?
Wow, that's, I mean, you know, that's a complex question, and it's deep. And you know, there's a couple different ways you can approach it and look at it. I mentioned those iterations and those changes, because even when we look at the youth themselves, one of the things that we're going to have to regroup and recalibrate on is who are our young people, who are African children today. Oftentimes we can say, well, it's the same, you know, these same kids as 30 years ago, you know, it's just, the stuff is a little different. They might have a little more TV, a little more music. You know, we come through with those notions, but the complexity of what they're encountering is, I don't think that it's ever been to this level. You're talking about a young people, and especially if you look at adolescents, which with the combination of diet and all of the other things that are going on in society, we're talking about, when we talk about adolescents, we might as well drop that all the way down to age 10, almost, considering what they encounter physically, physiologically, and in terms of what's put on them by society. But here's the other end of it. Because of what's been done to our people, you have to extend the back end of adolescence, unfortunately, and this is going to sound bizarre, but probably as old as 30 years old, because we have an extended adolescence because of an arrested development, because of lack of critical consciousness, lack of historical understanding, you know, the trauma that has been constantly and perpetually imposed upon us. So you got a front end and a back end that you're dealing with when you're talking about youth nowadays. And so that's one of the things that makes it more, you know, complex. And I'm saying all these things to say that when we look at education now, we're going to have to really look at helping parents, helping those individuals who do work with our young people, whether it be in the schools or in any other spaces where they are educated. We have to develop a deeper understanding of who our young people are before we can even begin to develop correct curriculum and correct pedagogy, teaching and learning. So that's the first place to start.
Yeah, I agree with you. The parenting process is the foundation of the educational process. And a lot of our children are not getting the parenting that they need and deserve. And like you were saying, we're going to have to help out those parents.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to have to, you know, create community parenting as a thing, similar to our ancestors, you know, on the continent, where, you know, the saying is it takes a village to raise a child. And a lot of those practices, not only do they have parents, but they have mentors as well. So I think that's something we can expand on and improve on. Would you agree?
Absolutely. It's a necessity, because if we look at it, many of the tools that we utilize on that 13-year-old, many of the tools that we feel could be successful to better educate and socialize that 13-year-old, unfortunately, and it's very unfortunate, are some of the same tools that we need to utilize for that 29, 30, and 31-year-old parent, because they are operating out of the same context, out of the same milieu, and we have to recognize that. And oftentimes we have an expectation of their socio-emotional maturity and say, hey, that's your baby. You should know better, that they need this, they need that, they recognize that. But they are operating oftentimes from the same mentality. and with the same set of tools or lack thereof. So that's something that we have to be aware of when we build that village around them, that some of the things that we expose them to, that we attempt to offer those tools, sometimes we got to have the parent and the child together receiving that same information, because they're operating out of that same context and out of that same, based on that same pathology that has been created by the destructive nature of white supremacy and how it's been enforced upon us.
I agree with you. When I was working, I used to have a little contract with MPS, and I was working as a family partner for a short period of time, and also training mediators, peer mediators. And I was training some mediators over at Greenfield Montessori School, and then I realized these kids have to go home to a situation which is much different than a you know, a school situation. So, you know, their parents aren't getting this training. And then I realized that we have to include the parents as well, you know, in that training.
Yes, absolutely.
Because if the children know that and the parents don't know that, you know, they have to go from one environment to another environment where they don't have that information.
That's right.
So, yeah, need a holistic approach.
A holistic approach. That is exactly correct. And you know, and it's complicated. And I know you all have probably talked about this many times, but, you know, it of course is complicated by the fact that we know that from a historical standpoint, if we just look at public school education, it was not designed to create a liberatory and a critically conscious mindset in youth. That would be antithetical and oxymoron to make an assumption that was ever going to occur. You know, it was designed to create subservient thinkers, and it has done a very good job of that. It's also done a very good job of at this point not only miseducating, but I made up a word one time. I said de-educating. And what I mean by that is, you know, the young people and many adults walking around have been de-educated to the point where they no longer have the capacity or a desire to want to learn various things, to desire to delve into things that that go beyond their consumer mentality or their consumer desire. Anything beyond that, any thought about learning beyond that, thinking critically beyond that, that has been taken away from us. There's been a, it's almost been, I don't even know how to describe it, but that capacity has been siphoned from us. And I refer to that as education.
Would you say that has something to do with not seeing yourself as a person of worth?
Absolutely. That is a huge part of it. And the I think the other part that goes along with that is, or the worth that I do see, when I get this hyper vigilant sense of worth, but it's all based on a very dangerous and dare I say self-destructive sense of worth, meaning that I can begin through my consumer appetite to attempt to purchase worth. I can purchase value, self-value, purchase self-concept. So then now you've got an unproductive sense of worth that we end up operating out of. So that's the other end that becomes dangerous.
Yeah, one of the things that I've been looking at for a long time, you know, even going back to college days when I was pursuing a master's degree in school psychology, because I really wanted to make a difference in education. But when I saw what the psychologists who worked with MPS were doing, and maybe not everybody, but they were just basically gossiping about the children, and they were, you know, giving them tests. And I decided, nope, that's not what I want to do. You know.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm just looking at if we change the paradigm and bring in Afrocentric principles, and that's one of the things the Sankofa Council of the Elders is doing, you know, Brother Alfonso Watkins started this group and about a year ago. And so I told him I would work with him, and I'm still working with him. That's why I'm hosting the show right now. But if we brought in Afrocentric principles, would that make a difference?
You know, absolutely. Ultimately, that is the answer. And what we would need to do, and I've come across some of this over the past 10 years ago, because, I would say 6 or 7 years, because I've been in some discussions with some individuals at various times and in various groups around notions of, let's just say, let's just take, for example, rites of passage programming or socialization programming, you know, culturally centered socialization programming. One of the things I'm finding is, even with our African centered principles, we're going to have to be very, and again, I used the term savvy before, but very particular about how we appropriate African-centered values in the context of the world that we live in today. Because we have to be very, very just aware that the bottom line is we have a generation of youth and young adults that have become so far divorced from notions of the continent of Africa, the values associated with it, the entire notion, the entire worldview of African centeredness is so far divorced from it that we have to be extremely, again, savvy about how we go about teaching those principles. They have to be palatable. We have to create an appetite for them. You know, we sometimes in our haste and in our love for those principles, you know, as elders and sub-elders and some of us who have come up in the knowledge of the culture, we want to stand there, we want to lecture. We want to come and have them, get them all in a room, and we want to begin to talk about, you know, the ancient African civilization, and we want to go through the history, and we want to say, this is what it is, and you should love this. You should know it. This is your history. You should be listening to this. Sit up straight. Get off that phone and just get on this, because this is what it is. This is life affirming. However, when we take that approach to what the way our young people have been conditioned and the way they have seen this society, we make a mistake immediately. So again, pedagogy, the teaching and learning, the approach that we use to this, We don't want to become so impatient on the one end or arrogate ourselves on the other end to say something wrong with these kids if we just can't beat them over the head with ancient Kemet. If we can't get them to understand the value of David Walker and Nanny, if we can't immediately if they don't make those connections, something is wrong with them. Put that phone down, stop listening to Rod Wave, get Bootsy off that, you know, we want to say that immediately. But we're gonna lose them immediately as well. We have to find
a way.
So what
I'm hearing
is that, yeah.
Well, maybe mentoring is an approach that we should expand on instead of talking to them, talking down on them, and criticizing them. Maybe we should be trying to show them the way.
That's right. That's right. Demonstrating it, and using the tools that they have available and those things that they are familiar with as teaching tools, and not immediately, despite, like I said, we know the destructive elements of a lot of the things of their culture and the subculture and much of it that has been imposed upon them, like I said, by their consumer appetite. But that will oftentimes have to be the starting point. We'll really need to start there with the things that they're familiar and comfortable with in order to use those elements as tools, starting with the phones, the iPhones, and everything else. How do we utilize Instagram? How do we utilize, Snapchat? How do we utilize the various forms of social media that they're involved in? How do we use images and symbolism and find ways to infuse values and critical consciousness into those things? It may be a slow process, but it may be the only way that we can do it. because that lecture, that what used to be that overhead projector, and standing there showing those pyramids, you know, it's not going to work. It won't work. And we can sit up all day and we can say, well, you know, that's on them. If they don't want to learn, they just don't get it. Well, we will be sacrificing 95% of the next 2 to 3 generations if we don't find ways to better utilize pedagogy, appropriate pedagogy, to make sure these babies get what they need.
But suppose fathers were involved. Suppose, you know, the fathers, even though they may not live in the same household because marriages are really, really down, and in Wisconsin, in the teenage category, only 7%, based on the 2010 census, only 7% of kids in that teenage category live with both of their biological parents. So if mm-hmm. the fathers would be involved, and 7% is the lowest in the country, and for Black families. But if the fathers were involved, would that make a difference? As co-parents, I'm saying.
Yes, absolutely. Equipped fathers, fathers who, first of all, and we know that most times they do have the heart and the love, you know, for their children, despite the stereotypes and the way media can twist that. But
right.
Equipped fathers is what it would need to be. And once again, you said it earlier, Brother Charles, that too would take a village concept. How do we identify fathers who have the ability to move the crowd, as Rakim used to say, who have the ability to move other fathers around them? They're respected. We equip those fathers. We have conversations, dialogue. We show principles that have a very that have a liberatory context to it. We equip them. Through relationship and conversations, they can move the 2 to 3 fathers, their guys, the brothers that they hang out with. That more so will have more value because those are the people that they'll listen to. So beginning to identify young men, fathers in the community who have that capacity, and then they become educators as well. And I think that's important as well, and creating spaces for that to occur and to make it comfortable, make those spaces comfortable and make them want to come into those spaces and say, hey, we'd like to share some things with you that you might want to try with other fathers to talk to them about that they may be able to utilize with their children. That's one way we can do it.
Yeah, that's real powerful. I was getting goosebumps when you were speaking about that. Maybe we could combine on a webinar or a seminar or something on that, man, because I think that's what we're going to have to do. Because the love that a father has for his child is so powerful. But if it's out of sight, out of mind, if you're not present, then it doesn't exist. But once the fathers get involved in their children's lives, and the research shows this, that, you know, it's a win-win-win situation all the way around, because they develop themselves to be effective fathers, because I don't think any father wants to be a fool, you know, in front of their children. But and it's reciprocal, because, you know, the love that you have for your child, and you are bringing that into existence with your presence, it's reciprocal. It's reciprocated. And then the father becomes empowered.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I completely agree. And I completely agree. And the thing about it is, when we talk about clever ways that we can assist fathers in that, and to make sure that we're in the right spaces for that to occur, we have to utilize spaces where the relationship is already there and the conversation already occurs. Because two things that come to mind for me right away is, if we're looking to forward an African-centered worldview, some principles, some values, the critical consciousness behind that, okay, why don't we start in the barbershop? Why don't we start the athletic spaces? For example, fathers will follow their sons when they hooping. and they do AAU, and they playing basketball.
That's right.
Let's work with coaches. Let's work with coaches because we're doing a little bit of that right now. There's some very proud of a few young men here in Milwaukee. Some who I coached or had relationship with when they were teenagers, and now they're some of the top coaches in the city, either in high school basketball or on that AAU circuit. And one of the things that they're doing is they are starting to have more socioculturally mature conversations with their players and their parents. One of the beautiful things that has happened, if you look at what has happened over the past year and a half here in society with the uprising, there has been an increase in social consciousness, and athletes, as we've seen, going back to the Kaepernick and beyond, are beginning to take on some of that. And young people now, it may have initially been like, oh, man, that's kind of cool. It's kind of like a fad to throw your fist up and take the knee and all of that. However, they're starting to think what is behind all of that. So if you're talking about fathers, they're there at their kids' practices. They're following from state to state with AAU. They're going to their high school games. Now, if we get coaches in rooms and say, hey, for your players to play on this team, scholarship bound and all this other stuff, we got some workshops we would like for them to go through. We're offering such and such in terms of that has a very African-centered bent to it. Now, they're going to be there because they want to hoop. They're going to be there, and them daddies are going to be there too because they want their young people to be a part of that basketball culture. But we can take advantage of those spaces and barbershops where the conversation is occurring anyway. And you have so much wisdom and knowledge and understanding going forth mixed in with a whole lot of other stuff. How do we utilize those spaces to educate and socialize?
Yes, we have to go to where they are. They will be at the barbershop at some point. They are going to be hooping, you know, and so we know and if we could speak to where they are, there's a poem. It's called the 2,000-year-old Chinese poem. I don't know if you know about that poem. I'm going to see if I can pull it up. It's a go to the people, you know, learn of them and love them and, you know, work with them from wherever they are. And this is not verbatim, but the last line is, and the people will say we have done it ourselves. So we have to empower the people, and we have to go to wherever they are and accept them however they are, and then listen to them, and then help them create what's missing for them in their lives.
Absolutely. That is powerful, and that sums it up. That has to be the approach. And again, Brother Charles, it's going to take some humility on our part, because when I think about some of our conversations, my 17-year-old Zion, she's a youth activist. She's been a youth activist since she was 11 years old. When she was 12, 13, the school that she was in, when she felt that they were lacking in an African-centered context, she did after-school programming. She was doing workshops with her peers saying, okay, come in here, and if they ain't going to give it to us, I'll teach some workshops on the Willie Lincoln.
Come on.
Absolutely. And Alfonso, he's familiar with Zion. He knows a lot about it. That's his girl. But I only say that to say, yes, she's my child, but you know, we have to be cognizant of how we create these opportunities for youth, and that so many of them that have a longing for what we have to offer. But one of the things that Zion would talk to me about is that, you know, you have to understand, even with this whole woke generation and people talking about being woke, they are still, even in their desire to change the world and be agents of change in this society, she said they are more and more disconnecting from culture, because you can be, she, and this was her quote, she said, you can become so woke and be out here doing what you're doing and shouting and doing stuff that you can be unknowingly beginning to fall into or back into a more Eurocentric mindset and further away from your culture. And you have to be very, very careful of that. So when we're working with young people, we have to always be cognizant of how we are showing up as well. Because if we are coming at them from a context of we have the answers, you all have no answers, you just need to sit and listen and we're going to pour into your head, that is not education. Because that doesn't work. The root of education is bringing forth knowledge. So we should be trying to draw out those things that are innate in them. So it's a process, but young people, they know what it is, but we got to meet them where they are. Just like you said with the with the Chinese poem, we have to meet them where they are, from wherever they are.
Man, we're going to continue this conversation, but right now we need to pay some bills.
Okay.
And I'm going to do a little commercial for our sponsor. It's a website created to provide a place to go. It's called eDoc Advice. eDoc Advice is a website created to provide a place to go to get answers to your health and medical concerns. The questions are answered by health professionals and those who are knowledgeable about helping you make decisions about your personal health that make sense to you. And their website is www.edocadvice.com. We do not replace your health. We do not replace your health professional or provide you care, but we can help you to become a better consumer so that you can get the best information to make a truly informed decision. The network with other health professionals throughout the country and bring that information to you. So in a couple of minutes, we're going to have our station break, but I just want to reiterate, it's great to be able to have a conversation about education and what's needed in our community. I understand that you're working with the Office of Violence Prevention, Brother Derek?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. The 414 Life, the Violence Interruption Team that I lead, is a project of the Office of Violence Prevention, and we're also connected as of recently with the Medical College of Wisconsin, because the whole notion is that with violence, we have to take a public health approach. It's a public health epidemic. And, you know, there are some of the same approaches that you use with epidemiology and AIDS and cholera and a number of other diseases, and the clustering of violence and all of that is some of the same techniques and approaches you have to use with gun violence.
So violence is a public health concern. And
absolutely.
There's a lot of literature out now about racialized trauma and environmental trauma and trauma in the body. And so is the medical model addressing that trauma?
And when we say the medical model, meaning the approaches are this, just like you have to go, your immune system, that system which is inside your body, the antibodies inside your body are the best disease-fighting system. Well, it's the same with the community. You have to... it takes assets that come from the community to be some of the greatest things that can deal with a disease and an epidemic like gun violence. The members of the team that I work with, they used to be the destroyers in the city. They used to be the problem, okay? I have some individuals that have been shooters. They've been some of the most dangerous folks out here. They've done time for it. They're on a redemptive journey, as we speak, a restorative journey. And what they have the ability to do, because they came from that life, they are some of the people that are best able to detect, analyze, and predict how and where violence is going to occur, particularly gun violence.
And then, of course, we're at the top of the hour. We're going to hold that thought, and we're going to come back just after that's over. Thank you.
Oh, sure will. Sure will.
But hold on, better days are coming. It can be rough in this world. I know it ain't easy, but hang on in there. I know better days are coming. You sing good. You sing bad, you've been happy and sad, but just remember that better days are coming. Friends will leave you by yourself, but don't cry, 'cause better days are coming. Oh, better days I see,
you are listening to the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee with your host, Dr. Janine James, Brother Kwasi Kraft, and Sister D.D. Connie. Sankofa Council Radio Broadcast is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, and it airs on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. Reach out to them at SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. I repeat, SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. All of our programs are archived, so just go to www.timeforanawakening, access the search portal, and type in the name of the program you desire to review.
We are back from our break, and we are again very delighted to have with us Baba Derek Rogers and our host from our Sankofa Council, Brother Charles Kwojo Robinson. Sister Dee Dee Conley is here with us as well, and this is Dr. Janine James. I'm particularly happy to have this conversation because we are at a very interesting time from the perspective of an opportunity for our legacy, the legacies that we are building, to do some fantastic things. And we have the expertise that we may not have had even 50 years ago. We have those of us who've had an opportunity to experience some education, some knowledge collectively that will allow us to do some things that we may not have previously been able to do. You have those of us who've had now the opportunity to gain knowledge to create a structure that should allow for our children to have the skills so that they too can create wonderful things, great ideas. But it's going to take some work for this to happen, and I'm delighted to hear some of the things that we're talking about, which are very thought-provoking. And I hope that there are others of us who are parents, who are grandparents, who want to know what is it that I can do? What is it that I should be doing to see that my children are receiving the type of experiences to be able to become critical thinkers so that they too can observe and have the skills to create opportunities and programs for us to achieve our greatness. We do have a listener, I see, 414-243, 414-243. Do you have a question or comment for us today? Four one four two four three. Do you have a question or comment for us? We're glad to have you listening with us today. Baba Rogers, we interrupted you for our station break, but we'd like to get back to some of the thoughts that you've had as a trained educator.
Yes,
who has drawn upon the learning, the teaching of those that have preceded us to incorporate that in your strategy. Where can we go to prepare our legacies?
Oh, my goodness. And it's such a shame that that is such a limited pool of both
tools and not tools, I'm sorry, such a limited pool of places and spaces that, that are currently available. And that's unfortunate. I would say that one of the things that I have found out, you know, through I spent 28 years in public schools, there are educators, there are public school educators. Let's just start with that realm, since the majority of our youth are there, the majority of African youth. There's a remnant, I guess I could say, of public school educators, Black educators, who possess the ability to infuse some of the type of learning that we're talking about within the construct of what's currently available in the public schools. We understand the Eurocentric programming that occurs there. We understand that that's, like Dr. Umar Johnson said, that's how the psychoacademic Holocaust is occurring there. They're putting our kids on academic auction blocks. Through all of that, there's a remnant there of teachers that we have to identify and support who are in those schools. And they need parents to support them because they're willing to take risks. They're willing to take risks to bring a different type of learning through in the midst of all of the testing and all of the standardized stuff and the PAT curriculums and all this other stuff that they impose upon our youth. There are still educators that are there, they're fighting, that are radical, that are risk takers. And we have to identify and support those teachers. That's critical. And much less if there's an administrator who is operating from either an African-centered worldview or just has the culturally centered courage to try to move his public school youth in a manner that takes them away from what has been prescribed to them. We have to support those individuals. I spent many years very unsupported as a young teacher, as a radical teacher. And even when you come into some spaces that, you know, could be considered pro-Black, African-centered, you may have to deal with a different set of politics where people are beating down on your opportunity to move even within those venues. But the community needs to, in the village sense, needs to do a better job of supporting what currently is, because some of that is there, and the little that we have, the remnant that we have, it needs to be supported. Those individuals need to be supported.
Yeah, I agree with that, absolutely. I remember when I was a first-year teacher, and they had this program called the MAC program. They had a psychologist and a counselor, two teachers and two teacher aides, and they put a lot of the challenge kids in that one class my first year. And, you know, so that, you know, they would bring in dice and all kind of stuff. It was kind of hard to manage. But I found a way. I decided that whatever shows up in the classroom, I'm going to use that as a teaching tool. So when dice showed up, I was teaching math, right? One of the courses I was teaching. So we got into probability, fractions, decimals, and those kinds of math problems, those kids had difficulty, you know, like dealing with fractions and changing fractions to decimals and things like that. But it was through using dice, you know, probability. One of the parents found out that I was letting the kids shoot dice in the classroom, complained to the principal, Mr. Davis. I don't remember Mr. Davis. But he called me down to the office and told me I couldn't do that no more. So you're right. We need to support, you know, creative teachers who can relate to the students.
Yes, we do, because I can totally understand what you were trying to do, and that's why and I had a number of educational settings going back even to the beginning of my teaching career that I created very similar settings for that opportunity. I'm a proponent, you know, when people were talking about don't segregate the kids and the kids need to be infused where all the other kids are, I'd be like, no, I would rather have the opportunity. Give me those kids, the ones that you don't want to deal with, that clearly you've given up on believing that they have the ability to learn. I would rather take them and give them a very positive and productive form of segregation, separated away from some of the other muck and mire of the Eurocentric education, and let me take that opportunity and use that space to give them some of the things that they need from a very culturally responsive standpoint. And even things like what you were just talking about, that's their subculture. How do we use that as an academic tool? Not in a sense that we keep them there, but in order to elevate them in their consciousness and take them to a different place. So utilize it as a tool, as opposed to it just being the thing that they know and that's all they know. It can become a tool. So I totally agree with that.
Yeah, also back in those days, we created the Expansion of Educational Experiences program. It was a pilot program, and then they merged it with the Department of Transportation and kind of watered it down. But I wanted to take my students to this play called Ceremonies and Dark Old Men. And I knew that if I could get them to see that play, they would become interested in literature, you know, and maybe even want to do their own play. And one of the guys who gave me the toughest time in the classroom, big old dude named James McAfee, come to find out a few years later, I heard that he was doing props for Hansberry Sands. But in order to get them to the theater, because you had to request a field trip, permission slip 30 days in advance, and we didn't have 30 days, so I bussed those kids back and forth in my little car. And I could have got fired for that, you know.
All right.
But it paid off, because James McAfee became a playwright and an actor. And I just discovered about a year ago, he Facebooked me. And I said, "This the same James McAfee who ran home to get a shotgun?" he ran home to get his mother's shotgun at me, man. He was so mad at me. But turned him all the way around. But that was because of the exposure, you know, the experience and exposure that we were able to get outside of the classroom.
Yes, absolutely. And that's what it's going to take. And you just described it, Brother Tribe. You were willing to take risks. This really is all about adults who possess an understanding of what's necessary. Are they willing to take risks? Because you also said it. You could have gotten fired. You could have gotten suspended. All the various things that that could have happened. However, with the sense of urgency that we're operating out of and the destruction that's occurring, if we are unwilling to take risks within the spaces, on the plantation, and then take risks outside of the plantation and make efforts to build independent, you know, parallel institutions which give our youth the education that we feel they need in order to become individuals who are not just serving this country but creating self-determined mindsets. So it's going to take risk, and we have to be willing to go there.
And those teachers who are creative like that and willing to take risks, they need to be supported. So how do we advocate either legislatively or community advocates? You know, the stakeholders in our community need to get behind the schools that are doing these creative things, teachers who are you know, able to connect with the students. Should we be more involved in school board politics? You think that'll make a difference?
That's a great point. Because school board politics, you know, it's a blessing that here in Milwaukee currently, probably more so than in the past 15 to 20 years, we have a couple of individuals who have come here in Milwaukee, and I won't even speak specifically, but here in Milwaukee, I happen to know that a few individuals have come on board the Milwaukee school board who happen to be risk takers. They happen to have a more culturally responsive and liberatory mindset towards what our youth need. So they're willing to push those buttons, push the buttons of superintendents, push the buttons of teacher unions, which is another huge piece, because these unions they will support the ongoing comfort and stability of white educators and their way of doing things, and protecting their jobs and, you know, the whole bit. So we have to challenge all of that, you know, from the policy level and from the board level. So that is an additional fight that we have to be willing to take. But again, in as many different ways that we can create alternative educational spaces for our youth, Brother Charles, we have to do it. A lot of them are going to stay right there in the public schools, but we have to find ways to create other spaces. And that's why it's important, because now you're talking money. Now you're talking finance. Now you're talking, how do you pay for that? Well, it goes back to some of the things that we were saying earlier. We may not see this, you know, as being the elders and sub-elders that some of us are. But if you're talking about, for example, these young people who are becoming professional athletes, okay, you create a generation of young people who are going out here and making that kind of money as professional athletes and musical artists, and they have a culturally conscious, a critically conscious, an African-centered mentality. Imagine what they may be willing to do with their money. Imagine how they may be able to support some of the independent institutions that we need built. Independent institutions in the sense of the ways in the 60s and the early 70s, there was such a very strong charge to develop independent institutions in Black urban communities. That entire charge died off, and there's only a dearth of those institutions still left in this nation. So that's what we need as well. And more importantly, I would say.
Now, school districts around the country are fighting against the critical race theory approach to history. And some states like Texas have outlawed the teaching of some of the real history about slavery.
And that is so interesting, Charles. Because I'm sorry. Where you finished? I'm sorry, because that one really gets to me for a number of reasons.
No, go ahead. I wanted you to touch base on that, and also beyond 1619. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, because even just the entire notion of critical race theory, this is nothing new, and that's why I preceded with what I just said. Black independent institutions going back to, you know, in cities like New York and Chicago, and some of the things that, and even here in Milwaukee, historically, that were developed, you know, 40 and 50 years ago. Critical race theory, you know, like, for example, the things that you were doing, Brother Charles, we've been doing that. And it was never termed, it never came under a theory, it never came under, you know, a different philosophical or educational context. We have been teaching Black history. We have been teaching African and African-American history. We have been teaching knowledge of self. It's been happening in spaces, you know, and not enough spaces, but it's been happening. So now, because of the way this has been brought out at a national level, now there's the potential that some of those individuals that I talked about earlier who were making efforts to create radical spaces, for example, within public schools, they may be hindered even more because of the attention that's been brought to this critical race theory. They've been doing it and getting it in. Now somebody might walk in their classroom and say, it's against policy. Not simply, I don't like that, or the black dude down the hall is teaching that black stuff again. Ah, there he goes again. But now it may be to the point where literally they cut off our ability to even do that within public schools, the very things that we've been doing and that have been productive. So that's very troubling. That's problematic.
Yeah, we're going to have to support those teachers who are teaching the truth, and, you know, we're going to have to advocate for them. And that means Absolutely. That we're going to have to be organized to do that.
Yes, very organized, because it's about to hit hard, and it's a it's definitely a clap back on so much that has happened in the last year and a half or so. And again, in that elevated social consciousness. And that's a clap back. There's no doubt about it.
Now, what do you know about the city of Chicago, which subscribed to the 1619 project? I heard that they actually incorporated that into the school district in Chicago. Is that something that we could do here in Milwaukee?
I don't know a lot about it, very minimally, but that may be an approach, since it's something that that people have been talking about. It may be a way to move something. I just think that we really are going to have to focus on a more concerted and broad-based approach to African-centered education in order to do what really needs to get done. And we really need to broaden our conception of what African-centered, and even defining that, of what that looks like, because it needs to be much broader than it once was.
Now, the Sankofa Council, we've been looking at creating a virtual online program. Dr. Rogers and I and Sister Fool, we have a committee, an education committee, and one of the things we've been looking at doing was creating a community university, where we actually teach Afrocentrically online to supplement, you know, the public education. So whether MPS do it or not, we still have the responsibility of educating our children.
That's right. Absolutely. And I think that's a wonderful idea and opportunity. It's necessary. We're going to have to be as savvy as we possibly can to get this worldview, these values, these understandings moved amongst our young people, because there are so many barriers to what currently is in terms of the educational system. Miseducation is deep, you know, and it's gotten to the point now where I was paying some attention to a brother, Baba Amin. He developed the Uhuru Academy, I believe it's in Florida. And I was listening to him one day, and I did kind of want to share this, because I think this is very powerful. He talked about how miseducation plus deficient education has led to three things: mass failure, what he called misplaced genius, and self-destructive brilliance. So I'll say that again. He said miseducation plus deficient or improper education or incorrect education has led to mass failure, misplaced genius, and self-destructive brilliance. And that is exactly what has occurred. And when he's talking about mass failure, he's not just talking about test scores and the academic element of it, but the fact that we no longer are the keepers of our own story. We no longer are the keepers of our culture and our own narrative. People are able to manipulate it and take ownership of it. That is a mass failure as a result of our miseducation and our inferior education. And then we already know about the misplaced genius, because we are operating in the service of our own annihilation. Some of our most brilliant people are doing the work and the bidding of the oppressor. We know that. And being paid very well to do that. And it has become a lifestyle. So that is misplaced genius, all of the brilliance that we have that is in service of somebody else. And then if you just look at when he talked about self-destructive brilliance, right away I said, hey, look at some of our gifted youth and young adults, their art forms, their ability, the things that they're doing. But it has been turned and focused in a manner that has been self-destructive, not only for them, but for the future of our people. So we have to, this has to turn around, because that all of that is exactly what's occurring, and we have to find as many ways as possible to combat that. So when you talk about you all using virtual methods, digital methods to get some of this information across and teaching, I think that's a great start. And if there were ways to infuse that in as many spaces as possible, I think that would be brilliant. Making it compatible for younger youth, taking our younger youth even beyond, because even when we teach Black history to younger youth, sometimes we're not as like what I like to call as sensitively explicit as we need to be. And what I mean by that is this: we'll teach them about such and such was the first Black person to do this, such and such was the first Black person to do that. That's a start. That's a layer. That's a foundation when we're talking about history. However, we have to begin to use stories, narrative, create books, opportunities, videos that take our young people into a bit more critical consciousness, because they're able to do it. We just oftentimes aren't willing to take the risk to go there with them. So if you guys can even bring that down to some of the younger children, and I mean, that's just a powerful concept.
Yeah, we need to talk about that further. There's a lot that we can do. Listen, we need to pay some bills again. I'm going to talk about EDOC Advice. At EDOC Advice, we provide specific medical answers to those seeking a better understanding about medical conditions and health. We offer our faculty of EDOCs, who are licensed physicians and health professionals who make themselves available to those globally seeking a better understanding of health issues and medical practice. Do you have a service that you want to share with others, that you want us to know about? Have you written a book that we need to read? Consider becoming a sponsor. Email the Black Reality Think Tank at Sankofa_think@outlook.com. Sankofa_think@outlook.com. And contributions to support our broadcasting can be made to Cash App, $NIRVANAINSTI. That's Cash App, $NIRVANAINSTI. And also at PayPal, Sankofa_think@outlook.com. So, I know we have a listening audience out there. This is a great conversation. Please call in. And you can call in at 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832.
Thank you for the comments that we're hearing today and the thoughts that we're having today. And I'd like to incorporate in our conversation, we mentioned Chicago, and I'm in Chicago right now. That's my home. And daily, literally daily, we have been hearing reports of attacks, random attacks of violence perpetrated by youth on the citizens of Chicago. And I hear this is taking place in some other communities as well. We've had many children who have been shot, many of whom have died. And you have to begin to wonder, while this is not a new event, but the volume that we're seeing is tremendous, in that we are not only losing those individuals who are the targets, but ultimately those individuals who were the perpetrators. And they are all our children. And I'm wondering what is happening with our compassion, our judgment, our ability to make decisions. This is not about people robbing for money, per se. There are people who've just been standing on the street corner, a parent and a child, and they become a target. It's not about somebody being disrespected, per se, and cause them to become a target. And so I'm wondering, where are we missing the boat as it relates to teaching right from wrong, morality, teaching compassion, care for someone else? I think it's a bit late to start this in the schools, but I would imagine multi-prong approach.
I have to read this quote from James Baldwin that answers, it addresses what you just said. I'm not going to read the whole quote. It says, if America is going to become a nation, she must find a way, and this child must help her find a way to use the tremendous potential and tremendous energy which this child represents. If this country does not find a way to use that energy, it will be destroyed by that energy. Now, James Baldwin wrote that back in 1963.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Can I speak to that, Dr. James?
Please do.
Yes. You know, and let me just give you all a quick story which speaks to I'm feeling that much of the issue, the core of the issue, the seminal issue, goes back to a sense of powerlessness that has occurred amongst our youth. If I look at Milwaukee, two of the biggest things in the city right now, if we talk about issues in the Black community, two things that'll come up quick when it comes to youth and young adults. They'll talk about gun violence, and they'll talk about reckless driving. Okay? Dangerous reckless driving. Now, I had something occur about a month ago with me. I was driving down the street here in Milwaukee where the speed limit was about, I believe, 40 miles an hour. As I was driving, a car came alongside me at what had to be 90 miles an hour. And as I glanced to my side, because it shocked me, it scared me, the speed at which the car came past me, when I glanced, I saw that it was a Black male who was driving. So he went on past it 90 miles an hour. It just so happens, 2 minutes later, when I pulled up not even a mile from the point where he passed me, he happened, that same car, because I recognized it clearly, was parked in the same gas station that I was stopping at. I went into the gas station. So I'm still a little nervous and very angry as well. However, when I went in, the young man was standing there, about to leave. And I said, you know, excuse me, son, you just came past me at about 90 miles an hour. That was you back there, right? So, yeah. I said, you seem like you was in a hurry. He said, yeah. And then this is what he said to me next, Dr. James.
He said, yeah, but you saw me, didn't you? I said, yeah, I saw you. I couldn't miss you. And then he said it again, but you saw me, didn't you? I said, yes. And then he said, you felt me, didn't you? I said, yeah, I sure did, son. And then he backed out of the door and he left. Now, in that moment, I stood there for about 10 seconds and I thought about what that young man was saying to me. He wasn't necessarily talking about, at least in his spirit, in his consciousness, he was not only talking about me physically seeing him through my vision. I had no choice but to see him. And what I mean by that is our young people, because of their sense of powerlessness, feeling invisible in many ways because of the lack of attention that not only society has paid to them, but that their own elders and adults in their community have paid to them. There's a sense of invisibility and powerlessness that they deal with daily. You don't see me. You don't see me. So guess what? I know how to make you see me. If I come past you 50 miles over that speed limit, reckless, I already have this innate sense of taking risks. That's a part of adolescence. That's a part of who I am, but I don't have any other outlets for this. So if I drive down this street at this speed, y'all haven't created, where are the recreational outlets? What's happening on the playgrounds now? What have you done and established for me? How have you squandered that inheritance of mine? So now I'm going to create my own way to find some power. And see, I can do that with a pistol as well, Dr. James. I can be powerful. So it's not even about at the point that I'm able to point that pistol, regardless of the outcome or the result of what will come at the other end of that bullet, in that moment, I feel the only sense of power that I have felt and get any place else in my life, in many cases, with these young people. So that is a huge issue with youth and young adults, particularly adolescents. But remember what I said earlier at the beginning. We're talking extended adolescence now, but we're talking about the 30-year-old too. But that sense of powerlessness is very real, and it's creating reckless, dangerous, random behaviors, because in that moment they get a high that they can't get no place else, and we're not developing any outlets for that. We're not giving it to them, and thus we get what we get.
It's interesting as you're speaking about this issue. Chicago came up with a solution, which is very opposed to or in opposition of the opinion that you've given. The solution to this is to purchase more high-tech cameras that would allow you to identify the vehicles that are speeding and to be able to better read the license plate. And in their report, they said that this measure will serve to solve the problem. And I'm thinking, who must have been at that table? Yes, yeah, it would allow you to identify the vehicle and even determine who committed the crime. But you still have a dead individual, a seriously injured individual. You haven't solved the problem.
That's right.
At what point are we sitting down? And that's what I'm wondering. Are there people who've been reviewing these cases? And it seems as though it would be relatively easy to get an idea or a pattern here, who, as you're describing, individuals who are seeking to get notice, to get attention. And if that be the case, then we need to be spending some of those millions of dollars that are going to be spent on upgrading the equipment on the expressway. because that really is not the problem.
Yes.
So I'm glad we're talking about this here, and hopefully there are other people who are listening to the way that people are thinking. And as I said, we cannot wait for the city, the state, the federal government to come up with a solution. To send out the National Guard is not the solution. So
right.
We've got money. We need to spend it in the right place. I see we have a listener, 505-340, 505-340. Yeah.
Yeah, I just turned tuned in. I'm listening.
You're listening. Well, welcome. We're glad you're here.
Yeah, I just turned up. Riding some horses, so I'm listening now. I'm listening.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you,
Dr. James. Can I please ask the family out there? Can you please mute your phones for me? The mics are very sensitive, and they can hear everything. So please. Can everyone just mute your phones? And also, if you have any questions or comments, can you please hit us up at Sankofa Council, MKE@gmail.com. Thank you very much. And then, Dr. James, can I just make another, I just want to say another little thing also. You know, when you were talking about how they were talking about spending the money, you know, to get more cameras and all this and that. These people can see what's going on. I feel a lot of this that's going on in our communities especially is a lot of stuff that's going on, period, with our children, with people. To me, it's by design. What would you say, Baba Rogers? A lot of it is by design. They can see. They know what's going on. Right at my grandson's school, a couple of the kids were filming before it even hit the news how those people are. How those young people were up there riding around on the lawn, chasing kids with their car. Because my grandson, they were filming, and he sent it to my son. My son sent it to me. I thought it was something that he saw on YouTube. He said, no, this is actually happening at your grandson's school. I said, what?
Yeah.
And people were running everywhere. This went on for a week. There's no way out there in one of those suburban schools some garbage gonna go on like that. And not only that, the news is always on us. You don't never hear what's going on in none of these other counties or nothing. And don't tell me they ain't clowning, because it's a lot of them right over here. I don't know if most of them are amphitheater actors, but there's been a lot of them you see right over here. You'd be so shocked. They got the hoodies on. They feed and feeding past you. And a lot of times, family, they're not black. I've seen white ones do it, too. I saw old white lady, both hands on the wheel, going down Capitol, and I drive a pickup truck. My truck has those that dual exhaust on it. So when I take off, people think I'm trying to race. I ain't trying to race you. So this woman takes off, and a lot of white people do not like you to be in front of them. Every year next to you or around you, they got to be first. If you get in front of them, oh, man, they're pissed. They're going to come around and get in front of you and then hit their brake. But to see this old woman with both hands on the wheel like she's fighting and speeding, I said, oh, my God, no, you're not speeding down Capitol. Can barely see over the steering wheel. I mean, a lot of it, like I said, that's going on, you all, is by design. And you hardly ever know what's going on anymore. And you hardly ever know what to even believe.
I agree. All I can say is I say to that, particularly what you said about by design. And, you know, it becomes another opportunity because of our lack of ability to enforce, create and radically imagine what education and an appropriate socialization will be for our youth, because we have not established that and or done enough challenging of and creating opportunities to create those spaces. We leave our youth in the position where they can be out there in those cars, end up locked up,
and then become profit for somebody else. So, yeah, designed from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
From the beginning. Yes, ma'am.
We know about the pipeline. You know, there is a school to prison pipeline. And that James Baldwin quote pretty much sums it up. If we don't find a way to use that energy, we will be destroyed by that energy. And that's what they're doing.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Yeah. If I may, can I have a quote also. And the quote was by Dr. Francis, where she went on to say, "We're the only people on this entire planet who have been taught to sing and praise our own demented. We go around calling ourselves bees, hoes, gangsters, dogs. I'm a thug. If you can train a people to hate themselves, demean and degrade themselves, you can oppress them forever. You can even program them to kill themselves, and they won't even understand what's happening." Isn't that something?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, Malcolm X said the same thing. He said, kill a man is not the worst thing, but to teach him to hate himself, to teach him to hate himself so that he will kill himself.
Mm-hmm.
We have a listener, 678-923. 678-923, do you have a question or comment for us?
Thank you very much for asking. There's a lot of noise behind me. I appreciate your contribution.
Thank you.
Thank you, sister.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for being with us. And thank you for thinking about the subject today. So we've talked about some things that are certainly relevant. I will share something I noticed. I was had some opportunity with my grandchildren, 6 and 8 years old, and I sat watching with them on their individual tablets, and they were mesmerized to watch YouTube Kids. And I don't know how many parents have taken the opportunities to sit with their children to watch. But I was certainly troubled, because what I was seeing is being mirrored in the children.
Mm-hmm.
The children were mimicking the characters with the gestures, the tone of voice. They are the storyline has little to no parental or adult participation with the children. The children are making their decisions, some of which certainly were dangerous. Little children were going to the beach was the storyline, and they got into the ocean, jumped into the water, how much fun this was,
mm-hmm.
without any comment about the potential dangers, the cautions, having a lifeguard around. This was really kind of frightening to realize that this is what the children are listening, and then noticing the defiance and the opposition of the children in real time when you are telling them something to do, and they're looking at you as if to really say, "I did this because I wanted to do this. I'm going out the house because I wanted to do that. I'm picking up your things. I'm breaking them. I'm doing this because I want to do it. Why are you even saying anything to me about it?" Now, I said 6 and 8 year old.
Mm-hmm.
So if, if that's not addressed, and mind you, I made my effort to address it, but if we don't address it and make an impact, then you will be 16 years old and you will feel it's okay to bother to take other people's things. And the consequences, or our society is prepared to deal with you when you misbehave. So I'm concerned that we must have some strategies, effective strategies, to point out that you still have a lot of learning to do. And there's some danger in the decisions that you're making. These are not the best decisions that you're making. And we are seeing that being emulated in real life. What
Dr.
are your
James,
thoughts about what we need to do about that? Yes, sir.
This is part two. I think we're going to have part three to cover what you just talked about. We are about to close out in a couple of minutes, and I just wanted to see if, and we've covered a lot of ground. Barbara Rogers, you have any last, you want to summarize anything you want to say to our listening audience?
Yes.
About just, education or maybe even violence prevention, either one or both.
Well, I'll just say, you know, first of all, thank you, you know, again for having me. And I know we're still diving deeper into a lot of philosophical thought and conceptual landscape and all of that. And there's still a very few practical solutions that we've been able to forward. But that doesn't mean that that isn't on the horizon. Because, again, as I said earlier, this stuff shifts so quickly that we have to continue to dive deeper so that it ensures that our solutions are solid and sustainable. So I don't want us to ever feel that these conversations don't have value or that we just talking, because this has to be put together in order for the types of things that need to be forwarded, like your virtual academic African-centered pieces. There had to be a thought process behind that, and I'm sure continuing to move that. So we just have to be aware of that. I don't want families and parents out there to think that this is just talk. We're moving in the right direction.
And I found that 2,000-year-old Chinese poem. I can probably get it done in 20 seconds. Go to the people, learn from them, love them, start with what they know, build on what they have.
Yes.
But of the best leaders, when their task is accomplished, their work is done, the people will remark, quote, "We have done it ourselves."
We have done it ourselves, yes. That is true education. That's the definition of it.
And can you hear me?
All right.
There's still too much noise in my background.
Yes, Dr. Tsai.
Well, I just wanted to share that part of the philosophy that I love to live by is to always ask those that are most affected, yet least consulted, give you the answers. They are the better teachers in that moment of conflict.
Yes. Thank
and
you
that
for
poem
that.
Reminded me of that. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you.
All right, I need to read this right quick. Thank you for joining us, our listening audience, today. I thank also the Sankofa Council for its support of this program and for sharing their vision for unity following Afrocentric principles and helping us to learn and use those principles in our lives.